The headlines of Russia and China accuse the United States of trying to destroy international legal architecture and trying to rely on Cold War era military and political alliances. Yemen's Ansarullah movement says it has launched a drone attack on Abha Airport in southern Saudi Arabia. And at least 15 people are killed and 400 others remain missing after a massive fire ripped through a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi and these are top stories this hour. China and Russia believe the U.S. is trying to destroy international legal architecture. That is according to a joint statement by the Russian and Chinese top diplomats. The statement accuses the United States of relying on Cold War era military and political alliances. It also blasts the European and Western sanctions as unacceptable. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is in China, where he met his counterpart Wang Yi on Monday and Tuesday. During their talks, the two urged the U.S. to halt unilateral bullying and stop meddling in other countries' domestic affairs. The United States has imposed sanctions on both China and Russia in the past month over various issues. The measures have escalated U.S. tensions with the two countries. Political commentator Xingzhu Xu says Washington uses unilateral coercive measures against other nations to serve its national interests.
We have seen over the past years in particular the frequent use of this unilateral coercive measures against other countries, in particular, for example, Iran, Russia, now China, and many other countries. So you can see the U.S. is trying to achieve its purpose without, resorting to war, much costly means, probably. So they are using their financial dominance, basically, to serve their national interests. And facing such a situation, other countries naturally will find a way to avoid the use of dollar or reduce the reliance on the U.S. dollar.
Yemeni forces have launched a fresh drone attack inside Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's continued aggression and blockade. Yemen's Ansarullah movement said the drone strike hit a military base in Abha International Airport in the southern Saudi province of Asir. Yemeni forces also said they have shot down an American MQ-9 drone over Flashpoint Ma'arib province. The retaliatory attacks come amid an escalation in the six-year war on Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians. Meanwhile, Iran has called for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which will enter its seventh year later in March. In a statement, the Iranian Foreign Ministry also urged an end to the ongoing blockade on Yemen. It issued a statement on the anniversary of the Saudi-led war, which the ministry described as a big crime against Yemeni people. Tehran denounced Riyadh and its allies for killing civilians on a daily basis. It also denounced the continued military support for the Saudi-led coalition. The Iranian statement stressed that there is no military solution to the crisis in Yemen. It voiced support for any peace initiative that allows Yemenis to decide their future without foreign meddling. Yemenis have declined a peace offer to put forward, a peace offer that was put forward by Saudi Arabia. They say the kingdom must stop its military campaign against Yemen and lift its siege before any negotiations. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali, has more.
Saudi Arabia has proposed a new peace initiative to end the six-year-old war in Yemen. The offer includes a nationwide ceasefire and conditioned reopening of Sana'a Airport and Hodeidah Port on the Red Sea coast. Yemen has declined the offer and called for an end to the war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia.
I believe the first step towards peace in Yemen should be lifting the blockade of the ports and airports of Yemen and ending this war as soon as possible, seizing and detaining oil ships, is worsening the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, and I cannot see peace happening without letting in oil ships, because it's contributing a lot to the humanitarian suffering of the Yemeni people.
Yemen has demanded the release of impounded oil tankers as the first real step toward peace. Moreover, the Ansarullah movement said bargaining over the humanitarian situation for military gains is a crime, and there will be no negotiations before the war is stopped and the aerial and maritime siege is lifted.
What Saudi Arabia proposed cannot be serious because it was presented a year ago. Saudi Arabia must stop the war and the blockade and stop presenting itself as a mediator in this aggression because it is part of it. Saudi Arabia must stop using the humanitarian situation as leverage to get political and military gains. There will be no negotiations before Riyadh declares its termination of the war and the blockade.
The Saudi initiative comes amid the Yemeni army's escalation of retaliatory attacks against Saudi facilities and its continued advancement toward the city of Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. Yemenis say Riyadh has released their oil tankers to prove its good intentions in order to move toward with a political solution. Otherwise, the Yemeni army will press ahead with its operations against Saudi targets. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
The United Nations says millions of people in conflict-hit Yemen, South Sudan, and northern Nigeria are at risk of famine in the coming months. A joint report by the World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization has identified the three of 20 areas as hunger hotspots. They say the number of Yemenis facing acute food insecurity will rise by 3 million to over 16 million, with 5 million of them being in emergency situation. According to the report, millions of people in South Sudan and northern Nigeria are also expected to be in a food crisis. The report warns that the numbers could rise further if urgent and large-scale targeted humanitarian action are not taken. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Algerians have once again taken to the streets in protest at the announcement of early elections in their country.
As for the next vote for the parliament, as the slogan said, it is a theatrical play. The system is illegitimate. It is impossible for us to accept this new parliament. This will be the case when we will be in the transition phase and when there will be a radical change of the system.
The protest was held in the capital, Algiers. The demonstrators said the elections are a plot to safeguard the government and vowed to stay away from polls. President Abdelmajid Tebboune has set June 12th as the date for early legislative elections after dissolving parliament last month. The moves are part of his promised reforms following mass protests by the Hirak movement. The protests began in February 2019 over then-President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's bid for a fifth term in office. Bouteflika was forced to resign months later after 20 years in power. Protests resumed 3 weeks ago after being paused due to the coronavirus pandemic. To discuss that further, we're joined by Abayumi Azakiwi, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, joining us live from Detroit, and Julius Mbuluto, political analyst, joining us from London. Let's begin with Mr. Azakiwi. Do you believe that the protesters will get what they're asking for?
Well, it has to be clear exactly what their motivations are. We're looking at 59 years of the ceasefire that was signed between France and the National Liberation Front in March of 1962. And since that time, Algeria has been governed by the FLN or coalition governments that include the FLN with a strong military presence within the leadership. It's not clear exactly what direction the Hirak movement wants to go in. They've been demonstrating now for 2 years, and it was paused because of the COVID-19 pandemic, which is a problem in Algeria as well. So hopefully they can resolve these internal problems without the interference of the United States or France in their internal affairs.
Now, Mr. Mbaluto, these protesters, as Mr. Azikiwe pointed out, have been coming out, of course, not considering the coronavirus pandemic and the halt in those protests. They've been having demands for more than 2 years now, and it doesn't seem that they're getting what they're asking for. Do you believe that another election is a solution to their problems?
The key thing with elections are supposed to be a reflection of change, and that change is the change that the citizens want. If you look into probably regimes, the way regimes work, the former president who resigned in 2019, he was running a system. He had his own regime. And most of the time when people are protesting and the regime comes down, most of the time the regimes, the remnants or those who are left within the regime are likely to feature in any particular change of government. Probably then a lot of people are thinking it's going to be continuation of more or less the same. Even if it's just a new government, but if the MP members of parliament are the same, most of them are the same as the ones who are in the previous government, probably the mindset is still going to be the same, which means no change will happen. To, of course, maybe to appease Algerians, they go to this bill, the bill that is supposed to be dealing with blood corruption and also giving voter more choice, but they don't seem to have a lot of faith in that bill because it takes a government that is endorsed and liked and embraced by voters to bring about change. And when the change comes, it is kind of trusted and offers continuity. But in this particular case, they've been a bit skeptical about this particular change. And also, the perception that also calling into election in June 12th seems to be like a way of allowing the current regime to carry on. And if you look into the level of election, it's not just election for parliamentarians, but also it goes all the way, it will be followed by election for mayors, election for councillors. So definitely you see it's going to change the entire country. I guess then they're looking into change. They are looking into proper change. They don't want rushed elections. They want election to reflect on their grievances, which they were protesting in 2019 until the former president resigned. And therefore, they don't want to see President Abdelmadjid repeat or become just like the former president. They want true change, and that can only be given where there is proper preparation and enough time dedicated to bring about reforms, even maybe before the elections happen.
Thank you very much. Mr. Abayumi Azikiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire out of Detroit, and Mr. Julius Mbaluto, political analyst out of London. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of the News Review, and thanks to all for following us. Moving on, the UN says at least 15 people have been killed and 400 remain missing after an inferno ripped through a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh. The UN Refugee Agency said 560 people were also injured, while 45,000 people were displaced after the blaze broke out in Cox's Bazar on Monday. It destroyed tents housing thousands of Rohingya. This was the third fire to hit the settlement in 4 days. The cause of the fires is still unknown, despite investigations. Rohingya are Muslims from Myanmar. More than a million of them are currently living in overcrowded camps in the town of Cox's Bazar. Most of them crossed into Bangladesh following a state-sponsored crackdown in Myanmar's Rakhine State back in 2017. and Germany says it will impose a strict 5-day shutdown over the Easter holidays next week to contain a third wave of the coronavirus.
We are at a place where we are now in a very, very serious situation. The 1st and 3rd of April will be designated one of quiet days with extensive contact restrictions as well as a ban on gatherings between 1st and 5th of April, an extended quiet time over Easter. The point is that over 5 consecutive days, people should stay at home.
Germany is also extending its general lockdown until April 18th, reversing a plan to gradually reopen the economy. Authorities say COVID cases are rising exponentially, and intensive care beds are filling up again. In the past 24 hours, the country has reported nearly 7,500 new COVID cases and 250 related deaths. Elsewhere in Europe, Ukraine registered more than 330 new deaths in the past 24 hours. That was a record daily high in that country. New cases were above 11,400 there. More than half of all UK adults have had their first COVID vaccination, with plans in place to immunize the entire population by the end of summer. Efforts are now underway to open a large public events with COVID passports as a possible solution. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, there is a growing backlash against such proposals.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalizing large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas, and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential four freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The U.S. financial fallout of COVID-19 has pushed child hunger to record levels, says Laura Unger, writer in an article published under the heading, Some of Wealthiest Counties in U.S. Have Seen Biggest Rise in Hunger. Stay tuned with more of Laura Unger's article. The U.S. financial fallout of COVID-19 has pushed child hunger to record levels. The need has been dire since the pandemic began and highlights the gaps in the nation's safety net. While every U.S. county has seen hunger rates rise, the steepest jumps have been in some of the wealthiest counties, where overall affluence obscures the tenuous finances of low-wage workers. Such sudden and unprecedented surges in hunger have overwhelmed many rich communities, which weren't nearly as ready to cope as places that have long dealt with poverty and were already equipped with robust, organized, charitable food networks. Data from the anti-hunger advocacy group, Feeding America, and the U.S. Census Bureau shows that counties seeing the largest estimated increase in child food insecurity in 2020 compared with 2018 generally have much higher median household incomes than counties with the smallest increases. In Bergen, where the median household income is $101,000, child hunger is estimated to have risen by 136% compared with 47% nationally. That doesn't mean affluent counties have the greatest proportion of hungry kids. An estimated 17% of children in Bergen face hunger, compared with a national average of around 25%. But help is often harder to find in wealthier places. Missouri's affluent St. Charles County, north of St. Louis, population 402,000, has seen child hunger rise by 69% and has 20 sites distributing food from the St. Louis Area Food Bank. The city of St. Louis in Missouri, population 311,000, has seen child hunger rise by 36% and has 100 sites. There's a huge variation in how different places are prepared or not prepared to deal with this and how they've struggled to address it, said Erica Kenny, assistant professor of public health nutrition at Harvard University. Erica Kenny added, the charitable food system has been very strained by this. Eleni Towns, associate director of the No Kid Hungry campaign, said the pandemic undid a decade's worth of progress on reducing food insecurity, which last year threatened at least 15 million American kids. And while President Joe Biden's COVID relief plan, which he signed into law on 11th of March, promises to help with anti-poverty measures such as monthly payments to families of up to $300 per child this year, it's unclear how far the recently passed legislation will go towards addressing hunger. It's definitely a step in the right direction, said Marlene Schwartz, director of the Root Center for Food Policy and Obesity at the University of Connecticut, but it's hard to know what the impact is going to be. Pantry managers said a disproportionate number of clients are from minority groups. Many lost jobs in the eviscerated service sector that undergirds the wealthier parts of their counties. Julie Yurko, the chief executive officer of the Northern Illinois Food Bank, said up to half of her current clients have never sought help before. In early January, we had a white minivan pull up with three kids, 5 years old and younger. It ran out of gas sitting there, Yurko said. The mum was sobbing and her beautiful children were sitting there watching her. Kelly Sirimoglu, spokesperson for New Jersey's Center for Food Action, said the stigma around seeking help can be worse in wealthy areas. She said some people tell her, "I never thought I would be in line for food." Advocates said the reluctance to seek help means the need is likely even larger than it appears. Katie Wilson of St. Charles, Missouri, said she heard about a food pantry run by the St. Joachim and Anne Care Service from a friend of a friend. She almost didn't go. The single mum of two children, 11-year-old and a 9-year-old, lost her job as a hotel auditor in June and tried to squeak by without her income for 2 months. "We found ourselves in a situation where it was a heat or eat kind of thing," said Wilson, a 42-year-old, describing having to choose between heating her home or buying food for her children. "It took me looking around and saying, there's nothing to eat." As hunger has become more visible in the United States, donations to food charities have risen. But they don't address the core problem of an infrastructure that doesn't match the new need. Some pantries are often just a few hours a week in church basements, a far cry from those that operate regularly and look like supermarkets. Many small pantries struggle to shift to outdoor food distribution during the pandemic or find new helpers when the few, often senior volunteers, felt unsafe doing the work. "It definitely is harder in these places," said Yurko, whose food bank distributes to Kendall County, Illinois, which has just 3 pantries for its population of 129,000. The safety nets are not as robust. "A strong safety net also requires pantries to cooperate with one another and a broader array of local social services. That's been happening for years in Flint, Michigan," said Denise Diller, executive director of Crossover Downtown Outreach Ministry, which runs a pantry in Flint, Michigan. Agencies and community leaders banded together in 2014 when lead poisoned the drinking water. "When COVID occurred, we were already kind of ready," Denise Diller said. "So was Atlanta. As in Flint, Michigan, hunger was never hidden there. 15% of children in Fulton County, which includes Atlanta, Georgia, faced hunger before the pandemic. After COVID suspended volunteer shifts, the Atlanta Community Food Bank asked the Georgia National Guard to help sort, pack, warehouse, and deliver food to help meet the needs of the estimated 22% of children experiencing hunger. The food bank also partnered with 7 school districts on more than 30 mobile pantries. Such coordination and connections were lacking in Bergen County, where 80 pantries worked mostly in isolation when the pandemic hit, County Commissioner Tracy Zuhl said. "They weren't collaborating. They were going along the same path they had for decades," she said. "That was this need to break out of the old way of doing things and work together to be more impactful." Tracy Zuhl spearheaded the creation of a food security task force in July, reaching out to municipal and faith leaders. Goals included feeding people, connecting them to other services, and turning some emergency food programs into fully-fledged pantries. "Building an infrastructure is painstaking work and ongoing work, she said. Now, Tracy Zua says pantries are starting to share with one another when one gets a large donation of perishable items such as eggs or milk.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians, from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
Cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events, and I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles. Mm-hmm. fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing. Mm-hmm.
And what are some of those angles, if you could please mention?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given at the very least cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, mm-hmm. and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to manoeuvre, room for negotiation.
It was very refreshing to see. Indeed.
Yeah, very much so.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, oh, there's violence on both sides, I was shot at once, I was shot at in my car with a machine gun, and then he's asked later on, why do you live with your children in this dangerous area? He said, oh, it only happened to once. Right. But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not necessarily being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, when I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this.
It was really interesting to see that Israeli author age over the course of this documentary. But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics. It was filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000, so that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal one, an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have some, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the road. I don't talk about the lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Chayadouaglut, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you for that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue, because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different, with all of its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident. It's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect through this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying, we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society, which has to adopt boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. There are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behave in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films, because even this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran as when he first started shooting all this and than when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the US government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world. And the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel Lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel Lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yes.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's, as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is who's to be master, that's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if we could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story and we have failed and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.